This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In her latest book, Diane Ackerman asks, what is it to be human? What is it to be humane? In The Zookeeper's Wife, Ackerman tells the story of the keepers of a zoo in wartime Poland. The German assault on the city of Warsaw badly damages the zoo. The keepers continue to care for the animals while transforming the zoo into a refuge for Jews fleeing the Nazis. It is a true story. The zookeepers, husband and wife, Jan and Antonina Jabinski, managed to save more than 300 people. Writer, poet, and naturalist Diane Ackerman is our guest in this portion of the program. She is the award-winning author of many books, including the best-selling A Natural History of the Senses. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments for our guest, Diane Ackerman. The telephone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. Diane Ackerman was born in Waukegan. She earned her MA, MFA, and PhD from Cornell University, and Ithaca is where she makes her home. You'll find out more about our guest at her website, www.dianeackerman.com. And she will be back in this neck of the woods next month on Saturday, November 3rd. She will be in Chicago to take part in the Chicago Humanities Festival 2007. She will do a reading, have a reading at 10 a.m. at the First United Methodist Church at 77 West Washington Street in Chicago. And for more information on the Chicago Humanities Festival and Diane's appearance on the 3rd of November, put Chicago Humanities Festival into your browser and you come up with the whole schedule of all the activities that they have going on during the festival coming up next month. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to talk with our guest, Diane Ackerman, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Diane, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be with you.
Are we talking? Are you talking with us from Ithaca today?
Scenic Ithaca.
Yeah. Is it a beautiful day in Ithaca?
Actually, it's quite a rainy day.
Yeah.
We have two seasons. They're both wet. We have hot wet and cold wet.
Yeah. It is a beautiful place, though, isn't it?
It really is. We have seven gorges, and it's a Latter-day hippie community. Wonderful.
Yeah. I want to talk about the zookeeper's wife. In describing her to readers early in the book, you say that she, quote, loved to slip out of her human skin for a while and spy on the world through each animal's eyes. We've all seen people who seem to have an amazing talent with animals. What allows for that connection? Can it be explained?
Well, Antonina, I think, was unique in the degree to which she had this very special empathy. She wrote a number of children's books from the perspective of the animals, right inside their sensory awareness. And she was so good at calming ornery, difficult animals and humans that before the war, her husband would send the most difficult animals to her to be soothed. She had a very special relationship with them. In her case, I think that it comes from several sources. She was an orphan. Her parents were murdered early in the days of the Russian Revolution. And children who are orphans or who don't have a very good relationship with their parents very often develop superfine talents for reading facial expressions and body language and other kinds of cues so that they'll know whether they're in danger or not. That's one thing. Another is that she simply grew up around animals, so she was very comfortable with them. And also Polish women of her era were trained to be, well, very attentive, let's say, to the needs of the menfolk in the family. And I think there were just many things that were combining. But a gift of compassion and empathy, some people are much better at it or more willing, let's say, to indulge in it than others.
How does one soothe a hyena cub?
Well, you act like a mom hyena. And among other things, that means lifting up the little cubs by the scruff of the neck. You know, they're programmed, just as lynx cubs are, to go limp when that's happening, so that the mom can drag them across the grass. You can actually see mother squirrels doing this, too, in this season and all seasons. And they'll look like they're wearing a fur collar, but actually it's a baby that they have draped around them, and the baby is just programmed to go limp.
Mm. Now let's talk a little bit about Jan. One of the ways you describe him is as a type of engineer. Antonina's father was an engineer killed in the Russian Revolution. But you describe Jan as a type of engineer, but the connections he fostered were between people and animals, and also between people and their animal nature. Tell us more about him.
Well, they both were natural-born zookeepers. They had a background in zoology. They loved animals. The zoo was only 3 years old when they had the opportunity to take it over. They both also had backgrounds in the fine arts. They were very Renaissance people, and they were thrilled to be able to spend their lives surrounded by animals. But they were very different personalities. And although they were both heroic, they were heroic in different ways. The zoo was an absolute Eden before the war. And unfortunately, it was doomed because the Nazi bombers, when they invaded Warsaw, dropped thousands and thousands of bombs. I think they made 1,100 runs on Warsaw alone. And they destroyed most of the zoo and killed many of the animals, turned a lot of the other animals to run free. And Antonina and Jan were Christian. They could well have survived the war without getting involved in rescuing Jews, but they decided to use their destroyed zoo to hide the refugees in the animal cages. And Jan was a very cool customer. His personality was just like that. He was a scientist. He prided himself on being a hard-nosed realist. He was very cynical. And he led a cell of underground saboteurs that specialized in blowing up trains. And he did lots of other things to thwart the Nazis. Antonina was quite different. Her heroism had more to do with radical acts of compassion. She was determined that people not just survived the war who were hiding in the zoo, but that they survived with their humanity intact. And that really, for me, was the most remarkable thing about her. She made sure that after hours, everybody would come out of hiding from between the walls and in the closets, and they were underground, and they were in the pheasant cages. They were everywhere. But they would come out after dark into the house, and there would be piano concerts and dinner and art and conversation and discussions. And while all of this was going on, she also was adopting orphan animals, as she had done for her whole life. And so she was raising them right inside the house, and there were all kinds of crazy animal characters running around. So the people who were in hiding also had the innocence of animals
mm-hmm.
to focus on. And I think that was a wonderful tonic for them, too.
Yeah, I think that that is a wonderful point that you make. The people who they called the guests had the animals around them, and then they had these two beautiful people who were caring for them as well.
Yes.
But at the same time, Antonina was frightened, terrified even. What would have happened to them and their young son, Rish, if they had been found out?
Oh, they would all have been killed. And there was a policy of group responsibility. They would have been killed. Their friends would have been killed. Their relatives, you know. I think it was especially hard on their young son, who was 5, 6, 7 at the time of the war, and who had all of these amazing dramas taking place in his house every single day. And there were underground leaders who were on the lam who were coming through, because the place was essentially an underground railroad. But he was not allowed to tell anyone. He was taught that if he told anyone about anything whatsoever that was happening, his parents would be killed, he would be killed, everyone he knew would be killed, and it would be his fault. This is a horrible burden for a child that young, and it has to influence how his forming brain puts together its view of the world.
Hmm. What kind of a person did Rish grow into?
He grew into an engineer, a civil engineer, actually, like his grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
I met him, a man in his 70s now. No pets, which is quite surprising. He lives in an 8-story walk-up. He says pets wouldn't be able to make the stairs. And he was very gracious when I met him and went with me to the zoo. The villa still stands. And I was able to go in and commune, and he went with me from room to room. But there was a part of him that was clearly cautious. And I think that that just got instilled very early on. How could it be otherwise?
Mm. How did you learn of this remarkable couple?
My grandparents came from Poland, and I had always been writing about nature and human nature and animals. And I learned that there was a primeval forest in Poland and strange animals, very ancient-looking animals running around in it, and I naturally wondered how they got there. And the minute I started looking into this, one door seemed to lead to another. I found that, yes, there is the last remnant of this kind of primeval forest in all of Europe, and it happens to be in Poland. There are horses and bison in it that look very much like the ones that the Ice Age hunters painted on the cave walls. I learned that the head of the Warsaw Zoo during the war was the world's authority on the bison, and that somehow all of this had to do with Nazi perversity. And the minute one thing started leading to the next, I found Antonina, that she had been adopting the orphans from there, that she had left a memoir and diaries. They were not translated, so of course I had to have them translated. And then I found testimonies that people gave who had been in the Warsaw Ghetto and who had sheltered at the zoo, and interviews that the Zhivinskys gave after the war in several languages. It took a while to put all of this together.
Yeah. Did you feel from the outset a connection with them?
I felt so close to Antonina, and I still do. I mean, we were different in so many ways. She was tall and thin and blonde, among other things. But when it came to her empathy with animals, that I really understood, and her innate optimism. She wanted to believe that pure evil did not exist, that people were innately good. And she not only saw evidence of this throughout the war, despite horrible things that happened to them, but she perpetuated that kind of kindness herself. And that was a wonderful thing. I felt so drawn to her, and I still do. And one of the reasons is that for some reason, we like to highlight the worst of human nature, and we don't hear about these stories of subversive compassion. But I believe that they take place every day on our war-torn planet. We just don't hear about them. I'm sure there are many rescuers right now in these days of genocide, as there were then. But the Jabotinsky story, like so many others, just disappeared between the seams of history. Nobody, even in Poland, people don't know about it.
Yeah.
And I think it's really time that they became role models, too, especially someone like Antonina.
Yeah. What can you tell us about why people like Antonina and Jan do what they do?
Somebody did interview about 100 rescuers and found that they had a lot in common. I mean, the obvious things, they were able to take risks more easily than most people, and they were comfortable with quick changes in plan and so on. But the key thing that they had in common is that they didn't think they were doing anything special. Excuse me, they just said that when you see someone in trouble, you help them. And that anyone in their situation would have done the same thing. They're uniformly humble. It's really quite surprising when you think of it. They don't imagine it as heroic. Antonina was a devout Catholic, and I'm sure this contributed partly to her sense of compassion and her sense of responsibility. Her husband was an atheist. He felt an equal sense of calling and compassion.
Hmm. He said she was really the hero of the story, and he said that her strength stemmed from her love of animals. What do you think about that?
I think he's right. I think that she was unusually heroic because she was afraid and acted anyway. He was capable of becoming very calm in scary situations, and he found them an interesting kind of chess game or intellectual challenge. He took risks. He was not a daredevil, but time and again he risked his life to get people out of the ghetto, for example. And it was essential to his success that he appeared to be calm. She was scared.
Yeah.
She was really scared all the time. But she did it anyway because it was the right thing to do. And he believed that she identified so strongly with being a mother animal that she could easily understand the fierce resolve that was required to protect her family. And when she thought of herself in that way, that was when she could become really ferocious, if need be, to protect the people around her.
Yeah.
But she was also very clever. Yeah. You know, she was very intuitive about people. You have to remember that these were two zoologists, and who better to know how to camouflage people in hiding, you know, they or how to exploit normal animal behavior in the enemies.
Yeah. I think the fact that she was afraid makes her so human to me. And it says that ordinary people, although we could say these people are remarkable and extraordinary, ordinary people can do extraordinary things.
Absolutely. In fact, I think that everyone, every single person that we consider a hero is not heroic all the time. The heroism was the best that they could rise to in privileged moments. And in other times, I'm sure they were absolutely ordinary, because human beings are. This is a story of what so-called ordinary people rise to, can rise to, if they choose.
Mm. And it's so much a story about connection.
Mm-hmm. Yes, about connections with nature and with family and extended family. And it's also a story about the lunacy of the Nazis. People know, I think, that the Nazis were trying to breed perfect humans while trying to exterminate imperfect humans. but I don't think they appreciated the extent to which the Nazis were determined to have complete genetic control of the planet.
They wanted to recreate animals and plants and ecosystems to fit their worldview.
Yes. Yes, they did, which meant, as far as they were concerned, pure ancient Aryan ones. And so they were pulling up crops, so-called Slavic crops, and getting rid of so-called Slavic animals, and moving the Slavic farmers off of their land and replacing them with German. And in the case of this wonderful primeval forest that I said got there by Nazi perversity, the reason it survived the war is that it was protected as a game preserve. Hitler decided that after the war, he would need pure Aryan horses to ride and pure Aryan animals to hunt and, of course, a sublime Aryan wilderness. And all of these things existed in Poland. This forest was the forest that many of our best-known fairy tales were set in, came from. It's an incredibly beautiful, ancient forest of 500-year-old trees and so on. And it's a world protected preserve now. But during the war, it would easily have been destroyed by the different armies, except that it was set aside as a special hunting preserve for high-ranking Nazis and for the head of the Berlin Zoo, mm-hmm. who was trying to breed back to these pure animals that we were speaking about and make sure that they thrived in their native landscape, which was this forest.
Mm. Tell us about that Berlin zookeeper, Lutz Heck.
He was quite a character. He was not only a zookeeper, he not only loved animals, he was a big game adventurer and hunter. He didn't mind killing animals if they didn't belong to him. So he would go out several times a year on hunting parties, and he would capture animals for his zoo, but he would also just bag animals as trophies to bring home. And he had been trying for decades to breed back to these pure animals, in part because it thrilled him to think of them running around again, and in part to ingratiate himself with the higher echelons of the Nazi Party, and it really worked. And he pretended that he was a friend of the Jabinskis, and after their zoo was bombed, he came by and told them that he would protect them and he would look after their animals. But in truth, he was stealing what animals he could for his breeding experiments. And on New Year's Eve, he even showed up with an SS hunting party. And they were all drunk. And he led them around the zoo. And they were allowed to shoot whatever animals were left.
Hmm.
It was absolutely horrifying for Antonina.
Yeah, I wonder if you can really say that someone like him loved animals.
Ah, well, that's a good question. You know, one of the things that really has come through to me from researching the book, and maybe it will for readers in reading it, is how complex the human psyche is. The Nazis, paradoxically, loved animals and hated animals, loved humans and hated humans, and all of that could exist at the same time in their minds. The zookeepers were able to recognize and capitalize on that. So, for example, on the one hand, there was a famous Nazi scientist who was punished for not giving enough anesthesia to worms during an experiment. But on the other hand, Mengele was allowed to operate on children in concentration camps without any painkillers at all. Somehow, these things didn't seem conflicting to them.
Mm.
They existed at the same time.
And here we have, you know, what I mentioned in my introduction, you know, what is it to be human and what is it to be humane? They're two,
yes.
two different things.
Yes. And also, you know, when we look at World War II, we see that genocide, it just reminds us that genocide has been going on for a really long time. And that, unfortunately, it is a very natural human-animal thing. You know, it happens throughout the animal kingdom. I suppose most notably among lions, you know, the male lion invades another group and kills the male of that group, also kills, or at least drives off the male, and kills all of the young that had been sired by that male, rapes the females to make sure that his own bloodline will continue, only his bloodline. We see this taking place all over. It isn't just among humans. But the thing is, humans can rise above this. We're the animals that are able to be merciful and seemly and moral. We're the ones who don't have to play by nature's rules all the time and who can look at this and say, okay, this is something that is natural, but it's not something we have to abide by. It's not the best of our nature. Mm-hmm. It's also perfectly natural for us to feel compassion.
Yeah. And I'm thinking here of something that Antonia wrote in either her memoir or in her diary, that at least humans can pack their essentials, keep moving, keep improvising.
Yes, she felt very sorry for the animals,
yeah,
of course, the zoo animals, because she could identify with them so deeply that she could picture the ones who were surviving and being sent to Germany and other places, that they would suddenly be disrupted and they would have new schedules and new keepers and they'd be taken away from their family groups. And it really hurt her to think about what they would be going through emotionally. We don't credit animals with emotions, but of course we share a lot of emotions with them, a lot of basic emotions. And she knew that. She didn't idealize them, neither did Jan. But both of them really respected and appreciated the things that all animals have in common.
Hmm. Are other species empathic?
Oh, yes. They really are. And part of the reason that that happens is because of something called mirror neurons. And we see people doing something, and we have little neurons that are triggered and say to us, wow, if I were in that person's shoes, I would be feeling thus and such.
Mm.
And so we feel empathy. And they found mirror neurons in many other of our monkey relatives, too. There are lots of animals. In fact, pet owners are probably familiar with their dogs coming up to them. You know, like if they're hurt, if you whimper or if you're hurt or if you're crying, it's typical for your pet dog to come up and try to soothe you. Many animals do feel empathy.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer, poet, naturalist, Diane Ackerman. Her latest book is The Zookeeper's Wife, A War Story. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. A little while ago, you mentioned folk tales, and early in the book, you offer a little bit of historical background about zoos in Europe at the time. And one of the things that I found fascinating, zoos were a way people, children in particular, could connect with their cultural heritage, a heritage rich with fairy tales that involved fantastic animals. Would you talk about that?
Yes, I think that's true. I think that's particularly true in Europe, and was in Europe. Now, of course, I don't like to see any animals caged. However, I think it's a wonderful thing when children can go to a zoo and meet animals that they're never going to see in the wild. In fact, I think it's very important that they do. They're not going to see polar bears in the wild. But it may well be the case that they're going to grow up and need to vote on laws to protect those very wildernesses. And they're going to be able to have a sense of what the animals are like and will be lost and what's at stake better if they meet them and they form a kind of neighborly relationship with them, if they understand that they are part of an extended family of nature. Also, there are zoos that raise endangered animals and take them out and release them in captivity. The National Zoo in Washington does that. The Chicago Zoo does that. I was in the Amazon with members of the Chicago Zoo when we were all releasing golden lion tamarin monkeys into the wild. Very few exist in the wild. They are genetically so close that it's iffy if they're going to survive. And so introducing new fathers and mothers can be extremely helpful for the animals to survive. And zoos do that too. The Warsaw Zoo still exists, mm-hmm. the one that Antonina and Jan ran. And it's a wonderful zoo right now, and they happen to raise cheetahs. And they've been extremely successful with cheetahs. Some they keep, and some they give to other zoos or trade with other zoos. And I adopted, in quotes, kind of adopted, a baby cheetah named Tosca. And people can do this, where in many zoo programs around the world, you adopt an animal, which means you donate money to support the animal mm-hmm. in the first year of its life. And when the book comes out in Polish, there will be some events at the Warsaw Zoo. I think I'm going to be in a state of chills the whole time, you know, remembering what happened there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Antonina's writings are so vivid.
Fortunately, she was a very keen observer, and part of the reason that I feel close to her is that she had very alert senses. She was very tuned in to her a sensory awareness of life. And as you know, I've written a book about the senses, and I just feel that way in my own life. And she took great sensory notes, and that has helped me enormously. But I'm not allowed to make anything up since this is a nonfiction book. So it was challenging for me, and I found it very helpful to learn about the natural history of Poland, to go to Poland, and lie down in the bed in her bedroom, look out of her windows, stand on her terrace and see what she saw, walk around the city taking the paths that she took, and enjoying the trees and the animals, the birds, and so on.
Total immersion.
Yes, total sensory immersion in her world. The other thing I did, which was just so fascinating, was to talk with a couple of women now in their 80s, who were girl messengers for the underground and had dealings with the Jabinskis and everybody else during the time of the uprising. And I could ask them, what were the sounds like? Were there birds there, or did the birds avoid the city? What did you eat? Things like that.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the resistance in Warsaw, in Poland. How large was it? How effective was it? Who was in it?
Oh, the resistance included many, many layers and classes of people. The Germans decided that the Poles would be punished in a very special way as a kind of object lesson to the rest of Europe. And it wasn't just the Jews that the Nazis wanted to wipe out. It was all Slavs. That was a large group of people. So it was Jews, it was Catholic, most of Poland was Catholic, and so the resistance included much of the intelligentsia, the doctors, the lawyers, everybody who had not been murdered outright by the Nazis, and it was large. It was extremely effective and respected throughout Europe during the time of the war, and even respected by its enemies, because it was so elaborate and clever. And there were many, many different cells and departments that made it hard to uncover. There were a lot of rescuers, and I think people don't appreciate that. For one person to survive, it could take hundreds of people to be complicit. Not just people protecting them, but people who turned and looked the other way. The mailman, the person who delivered milk, the maid. There were so many people who had to pretend not to know, as well as to actively help for just one person to survive, that there were tens of thousands of people, non-Jewish people, in Warsaw alone that were involved helping others escape.
Tell us something about the work that the Jabinskis did in this regard. How were they able to get people in and out of their home in the zoo?
They, first of all, Jan was very good at understanding human nature. And he persuaded Lutz Heck and Heck's Nazi bosses that the zoo really needed to raise pigs to feed the German soldiers. And of course, he said that meant that he would need scraps to feed the pigs, and so this got him a pass into the Jewish ghetto to collect scraps. Well, there were no scraps. There were no extras in the ghetto. What he did was smuggle food in and money in and ultimately people out. There was a they decided that they would have a fur farm to clothe the German soldiers. On another occasion, a high-ranking Nazi who happened to work in the labor office, which adjoined the ghetto, in a building which happened to have a back door that was little used but led to the ghetto, this Nazi arrived at the zoo, said he was an insect lover, and had heard that there was a famous insect collection at the zoo, and could he please take a look at it? The Jabinskis thought this was it. They had been discovered. But they just teased a few little things out of the man and realized, no, he really just wanted to see this insect collection that was hidden at the zoo, and so they showed it to him. And Jan explained to him that, well, of course, the insect collection could be damaged. It could succumb to mold or something else. So Jan would need to consult with the man whose collection it was, who was in the Jewish ghetto. And the Nazi agreed to this, took Jan with him back to the labor office. Jan made it known that he would need to come often to consult. And with one move and another, the next thing anyone knew, Jan was smuggling people out of the ghetto one by one. And then they would get smuggled in through the lions' cages at the zoo, from there to the pheasant's house, from there through a tunnel into the villa, and so on. And they had their son carrying food to the people who were in hiding because they rightly said that the Germans would not suspect a child that young of being a vital part of this Underground Railroad. And also then they could just say to their son, they could give him a bowl of soup and say to him, I think the squirrels need to be fed, or you better feed the lions. They gave all of the people who were in hiding in the cages the names of the animals who had once lived in the cages. All of the animals that were pets and lived indoors had human names. That's how they told the difference between them. So they could say easily to their son, you know, the lynxes need to be fed. And he would know that the lynxes were really the people who lived in the pheasant cage or wherever.
Yeah. A lot of smart, quick thinking.
A lot of it. Yes. It was really one of the most successful hideouts of World War II. And over 300 people survived. Only two died, and they died of illness. Everybody else got out.
What became of those who survived? Where did they go? Maybe you would tell us about an individual or two.
Well, some of them went to England. Some of them went to Israel. And many of them vanished, and I'm very much hoping that if there is, say, a child who sheltered at the zoo, who would now be in his or her 70s or 80s, that person will get in touch with me. I want to know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Polish is a language with extra letters, as far as we're concerned, as English speakers. And in Polish, the women's names change anyway when they marry. So it's hard to keep up with people and find out what really happened to them. But after the war, those who lived in Israel nominated the Jabinskis to become righteous among nations, a very select group honored by Israel. And Jan went to Israel and to receive the medal, but both he and Antonina were celebrated in this way. And if you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., you will find them on the list of rescuers from all the different nations. There's a photograph of Jan there, not of Antonina, but both of their names are listed as rescuers. I just received a letter this past week from a woman who knew a woman who knew Jan, and knew that Jan, when he was ill, moved to Israel at a certain point to live. I didn't know that. To live among friends, people that he had sheltered.
Mm-hmm. What were their days like after the war, the Jabinskis?
Well, they did survive the war. Lots of adventures and misadventures on the way to that. Jan was wounded, and of course they were split up. Jan was in a POW camp. But they did all survive and reunite after the war, and they had to rebuild the zoo. And that took a lot of rebuilding. But the citizens of Warsaw contributed 300 animals. It's an interesting number. You know, they saved over 300 people, and there were 300 animals contributed. It's almost as if it were commemorative. And they got the zoo going. But Jan retired as a zookeeper after only 3 years. There's no record of why. And his son couldn't tell me why exactly. But I think that it's because the Soviets came in after the war, and when they did, it was not at all popular to have been a freedom fighter. And in any case, Jan would have been answering to the Soviet bosses, and I think that life was just unlivable for him under that regime. And so he retired from the zoo. He didn't retire from being a zoologist. He began doing a weekly radio broadcast on the behavior and the lives of animals, and that's how most people in Poland who are still alive, who were alive in World War II, remember him as a radio personality who talked about animals. Antonina began writing children's books from, as I say, about animals, and they both wrote a lot of books. And so between them, they were able to support their family in these ways.
Yeah. It must have been very difficult to go through, come through one period of horror, and then to see another period of repression and oppression
very difficult.
Fold on top of Poland.
Very difficult, but Poland has a history of being invaded and rearranged and having its borders changed over and over and over throughout history. It happens for its benefit and also as a curse to be strategically located in Europe, and so it was constantly at war. And my grandfather, although he was not formally educated, had to learn 5 languages just to talk with his neighbors when he was a child, because everything was changing. There were so many different countries that were involved. So it wasn't at all pleasant, but it was something that they certainly had a long history of living through. I think it was very difficult for them, very difficult.
Hmm. There, we'll leave it. We're out of time. Diane, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Oh, it's been a pleasure sharing this amazing story with you and your listeners.
Yes, it's a marvelous, wonderful book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Diane Ackerman has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author, most recently, of The Zookeeper's Wife, A War Story. The book is published by Norton. You'll find our guest, more about her, at her website, www.dianeackerman.com. www.diananackerman.com. And next month, on November 3rd of 2007, she'll take part in Chicago's Humanities Festival. She will do a reading Saturday, November 3rd at 10 a.m. at the First United Methodist Church at 77 West Washington Street in Chicago. And for more information on that, you can put the Chicago Humanities Festival into your browser.